Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We continue our hour on design. Kyle Shaka, author of the new book, The Longing for Less, Living with Minimalism, writes, quote, art becomes retail surprisingly quickly. And that seemingly simple idea is key to the theme Shaka presents. The book is not a decluttering book or a how-to. The Longing for Less explores how minimalism, with its origins as a mid-century avant-garde art movement, has undergone a radical transformation in the 2010s, when Marie Kondo appeared in everybody's Netflix queue, and IKEA's brand of white and blonde wood furniture seemed ubiquitous, and hashtag minimalism was all over aspirational Instagram and blog posts. Part art history, part cultural criticism, the book The Longing for Less argues that we need a more nuanced understanding of what minimalism is and isn't. Kyle, welcome to All of It.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the book began as an essay that was called The Oppressive Gospel of Minimalism. What inspired that essay?
Well, I think I started seeing the word minimalism everywhere. As you kind of referenced, people use minimalist to describe like the interior of a restaurant or their apartment or their closet or their skincare routine. And so I was just kind of confused as to why this particular word was being used with so many different things. And my own reference frame as a kind of art critic and art historian was minimalist art proper in 1960s New York. So I kind of wanted to figure out if those two things connected at all and kind of how that change had happened.
So the book has a different tone than The Oppressive Gospel of Minimalism. It's The Longing for Less. What did you want that title to signify or to imply?
Yeah, well, minimalism as a word is kind of complicated because it has such a diffuse meaning. So I wanted to get away from the word itself a little bit and just talk about what drives minimalism, which I think is this desire to live more simply and to live a less complicated life and to maybe have less clutter around you. So this was that idea of like the longing for less. And it's longing, I think, because you never quite get to the end goal of that. Like there's no end point of minimalism, I don't think, unless you just live in an empty space.
When did you see this longing start to appear?
I think particularly it started in the years after the financial crisis, mm-hmm. So kind of circa 2008, 2009. And at that point, you know, living more simply was kind of a necessity. And we, you know, especially as a millennial who's graduating college around that time, we had to kind of reframe our expectations for our adult working lives. And I think that combined with the rise of the social media internet and kind of the way we consume a lot of images online really accelerated minimalism, because the minimalist aesthetic is really well adapted to the internet. Like this clean white space is kind of minimalist already.
So those are the cultural forces that were behind the growth of this interest in minimalism. Did you gain through your research why people were attracted to it?
I think what I found was that people use this idea of lifestyle minimalism as a means of controlling their surroundings.
Huh,
like the world is so complicated and overwhelming, and you know, we have such a fraught relationship with consumerism, especially now, that minimalism became like a tool to rethink your relationship with what's around you and almost like narrow down what you're confronting to what's just right around you. So maybe, you know, the world is overwhelming and confusing, but you can clean your apartment and like make it look neater. And maybe that will help you clear your minds or like feel like you're in control of something when actually you're kind of not in control.
My guest is Kyle Shaka. The name of his book is The Longing for Less, Living with Minimalism. And the book is separated into four sections: reduction, emptiness, silence, and shadow. How did you identify these four these four quadrants?
Yeah, they're very abstract. So to me, like, minimalism doesn't have a particularly chronological history. Like, I don't think you can say A happened, then B happened, then C happened. So I wanted to structure the book in these like thematic chapters. And to me, each of those is kind of a different flavor of absence, or like a different flavor of minimalism. So reduction is the desire to live simply and kind of do the Marie Kondo ritual of throwing everything out. And then emptiness is the kind of aesthetic of absence that you see in minimalist art and architecture and design. And then silence is about the overwhelming sensory perception that we have today and the ways in which like composers have dealt with it in the past through minimalist music. And then shadow is about the roots of minimalism as an idea in Japanese Buddhism and kind of living with ambiguity and absence as a philosophy.
And you take on the saying less is more. We've heard that less is more, less is more, less is more and more. Yes. And more. Where, you know, I think it's often attributed to architects and art design. Is that accurate?
It's not quite accurate. So where it comes from, the most commonly cited source is the architect Mies van der Rohe, who is a German member of the Bauhaus, and he was a huge pioneer of modernist architecture and the kind of clean, empty aesthetic that we all know and love. But the first time the phrase less is more appeared in English was actually with this poet, British poet Robert Browning, in the late 19th century. And he kind of put it in the mouth of this Italian Renaissance painter, Andrea del Sarto. And he uses less is more as a critique, actually, that like Andrea del Sarto focuses way too much on like being perfect and exact. And actually by doing less, you can achieve a better effect. So I think like that kind of goes against modernist architecture like Mies van der Rohe's, because his stuff is very perfect. And like minimalism right now is this cliche of perfection where everything has to match and be perfectly empty. But actually, I like this earlier definition of less is more, that like maybe you shouldn't try too hard to be perfect, or otherwise you might ruin it or like be too cold.
Does the, not the word minimalism, but the ideas of minimalism, do they appear in ancient philosophy?
I think so. I mean, they're not going to go by the name minimalism exactly, because that word was only invented in 1964. But I think this idea of living simply has a really long history, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the kind of connection between asceticism and spirituality has always been there. So I think you can look back to the origins of Buddhism. You can look back to the early Catholic Church, and you know, the connection between like suffering and piety was clearly there already. Or even the kind of the Greco-Roman philosophers who advocated living simply, or like just going with the flow of the world rather than resisting it, as a way of living. So I think these ideas have always been present in our culture. It's just that like now we have this convenient label for them, that has become a kind of brand name.
My guest is Kyle Shaka. The name of his book is The Longing for Less, Living with Minimalism. And as you said, minimalism, the word, appeared in the mid-60s. Richard Wolheim, he's an essay called Minimal Art. Who are the artists he was pointing to that he described in terms of minimal art?
Yeah, so this was a group of artists in 1960s Manhattan, who were making this kind of art that looked really like simple and almost boring on the outside. So people like Dan Flavin, who used electric light fixtures as sculptures, or Donald Judd, who made metal boxes and just put them on a gallery floor, or even Yayoi Kusama, who is now known for her like Instagram-y infinity rooms. She was making these weird furniture sculptures that were like a sofa covered in little fabric protrusions. And so these artists, Richard Wolheim observed, were like making stuff that didn't look like art necessarily. Like these weren't elaborate paintings or like emotional abstract expressionist canvases. Instead, they were just kind of weird objects that sat there and didn't do anything. So he argued that they had this minimal art content, like they didn't do what you expected of them. But to him, his argument was that actually minimal art is a form of art and is like worth appreciating, because the artist is just making a different set of decisions. Like rather than deciding how to pose a human figure, they're deciding how big of a metal box to make or how to treat the aluminum exterior. And those are all valid artistic acts as well.
It was interesting to read, you know, when you think about minimalism, you always go to the visual, but then you include also minimalism in music. And so that our listeners get a sense of what you're talking about, let's listen to a bit of a performance of a piece by Julius Eastman. ¶¶ So Kyle, what did you want to explore about minimalism in music and the music of someone like Julius Eastman?
I think I wanted to show that minimalism could occur in all of these different cultural forms, like not just in interior design or visual art, but in music as well. And I think similar to how the minimalist artists used industrial materials and kind of reclassified them as art, the minimalist composers like Julius Eastman they kind of appropriated little bits of found sounds and repeated phrases of music and used those as like the building blocks of their compositions. So, you know, where in earlier centuries, maybe music is a symphony that moves you emotionally and carries you through this story, instead, minimalist music, like that beautiful piece we just heard, is kind of more of about a mood or like a vibe that gets created by this repetition of a particular phrase. And Julius Eastman, who is a Black gay composer in 70s New York, was like particularly strong at like using these tools to really break down our expectations of what music could be. And I thought that was interesting. Like, I think the most powerful forms of minimalism cause you to appreciate things that you didn't think about before, or find beauty in places that you didn't expect. And I think he really succeeds at that.
When we talk about today's minimalism, and you write about it in this book, you write about it as something you describe as airspace.
So,
yes. What does airspace look like? And how did you conceive of this idea as today's minimalism is airspace?
Yeah, it's a kind of parallel thing. So I think I wrote this essay called Welcome to Airspace in 2016, I think, which was when I was starting the minimalism book. And I had been going to, or like staying in a lot of Airbnbs for work, just doing, you know, reporting trips for articles. And I kind of had this feeling that all the different Airbnbs I had stayed in had this kind of homogenized quality. Like, they all had particular design quirks. They often looked kind of minimalist. And so I was wondering why all these different places all that were sprinkled around the world kind of looked similar. And this was the same kind of aesthetic that I found in coffee shops or kind of startup offices, where whether you're in New York or Berlin or Bali or Beijing, you can like find a coffee shop that looks like this, or like an Airbnb that looks minimalist and clean. And my argument was kind of that airspace is this like homogeneous geography that technology and social media creates, that like easily lets us move from place to place without experiencing like the fundamental culture of the place that we're in, and it allows us to cherry pick the spaces we inhabit, so we can just always choose the minimalist Airbnb rather than picking something that's like more unique or more different than what we're used to. It's a kind of like frictionless existence, I think.
Something I find interesting is the idea of minimalism equaling prosperity. Because once upon a time, if you had a lot of money and you had a big house, you just filled it. And things were gold and opulent, you know, like Louis XIV. Mm-hmm. And now a sign of wealth and prosperity is simplicity and clean lines. Maybe large,
yes.
Still enormous,
yeah.
Yet it's got this certain aesthetic. When did minimalism start to become symbolic with prosperity?
Yeah, I think it was a process from the 60s through the 2010s, maybe. So mm-hmm. it took a while. And I think one aspect is that like stuff is so widely available now. Like, we can order anything on Amazon and get it delivered tomorrow, unfortunately. That like the rich or the wealthy or the elite had to find a different way of signifying their own eliteness. So if anyone could have a lot of stuff, then the way that you make yourself distinct is actually having less stuff, going in the opposite direction. And I think that aesthetic of emptiness that you find in like the architecture of John Poston or like Kim Kardashian's house, that was kind of a consequence of minimalist art. Like, minimalist art, because it looked so normal, kind of needed these very blank, austere gallery spaces to be shown in. And these gradually became known as white cubes, like the white empty gallery was a signal to the viewer that this art was important and not just like a normal metal box. But unfortunately, I think we've like appropriated the art gallery aesthetic for our houses now.
And for selling things.
Yes, for sure. Like in fashion boutiques for luxury brands. And that's kind of how the movement happened from like a high art radical minimalism to like a totally commercialized minimalism. But I don't think like living in an art gallery sounds good to me.
The name of the book is The Longing for Less, Living with Minimalism. Kyle Shaka, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. This is great.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.